I'm Emily Theed, author of This Vicious Grace, coming in summer 2022 from Wednesday Books.
And I'm Anna, a teacher and a writer in the Queery Trenches.
And you're listening to Basic Pitches, where we...
Two basic pitches.
Break down the basics of writing and being a writer.
It'll be fine.
We're excited.
That's exactly what I say, because we're just diving into this episode.
Yes, we are.
I feel like you and I chatted enough that I don't know what to chat about now.
Yeah, we did our banter off the air. Sorry about that, folks.
It's okay. Sorry.
It wasn't like super entertaining banter. It was very much just like mundane daily banter.
It's true. It's true. Maybe we should put snippets of it in there so people know that.
Yeah.
We're just normal, grumpy, just
normal, kind grumpy people complaining about noisy neighbors and all that stuff. Yes, exactly. Because we come across as so aloof and above the fray. Gotta make sure everyone knows that we're just normal people. In case you're in doubt, folks.
In case you're in doubt that this laugh, that this podcast, that all these things we say.
Yes. Poised and polished. Sense. Living in our luxury apartments.
Celebrity status.
Yes, with our butlers, you know, all that good stuff. Fancy. Whereas I'm the person who, like, I have a friend who, we're all trying to figure out hotel rooms for Y'all Fest. One friend, I won't name them, but is looking at a really fancy hotel room, and my first thought was just, if I stayed in that hotel, I'm going to spend the entire time taking pictures for Instagram so I can look like a fancy person on my Instagram.
No.
That's how cool I am. I'm like, ooh, fancy hotel. First thought is like, post pictures for Instagram. I could stock up and have a whole month of me being like, this is just me in my fancy place.
I don't know. How can I say this that I don't have to edit it out of the podcast? Okay. So I live in what I commonly refer to as the armpit of North Carolina. All right. So that lets you know a little bit about my personality, just the phrasing of that in general.
Yes. I love it. Evocative.
Evocative. Yes. You know, you're really there. You're really getting the moist.
Sensory.
Sweat. sensory detail. The local flair of where I live. Anyway, so the first time I went to Y'all Fest, it was this beautiful thing of like, look at all these people. They're so fabulous. And like, you know, the authors, some of them are like, I mean, they're real designer chic.
And yeah, that's not gonna like, be me.
Hey, I showed up in my overalls and my oversized sweater that has holes in it.
I love it.
So the concept of me staying at a fancy hotel in any
well, the funny part to me is that like it in my head it's like, oh, I could take fancy pictures at a fancy hotel and then my Instagram would look like a fancy author, except I know I wouldn't be able to do it with a straight face. So instead it would just be me like being too posh and it would be a joke.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like it would end up just me being like, here I am, fancy person, and like just look like the poser I'm totally being, which I feel like is actually just as fun. But honestly, here's the big thing. It's not even that I want people to think I live a fancy life. It's just that Instagram is exhausting because I have children. I can't take a picture anywhere in my house without having to like clear toys off the floor behind me. And so just the thought of being in a place that is clean and neat and organized, and I could just, you know, take a darn selfie without being like, could someone move that purple My Little Pony out of the corner of the frame, would just be so relaxing.
But here's the thing, Emily. You have children, and you're like, can I move that thing? And then I'm looking around my house going, it looks like somebody tried. Like, they try to be organized.
I would like it to look like someone tried, because my house looks like someone has not tried. And I have tried. And that's a bad combination.
Have you seen that corner you post all the time? If you guys aren't following Emily on Instagram,
she has a corner.
It's one corner, but it looks great.
I still have to clean it up every single time for one corner.
I don't know, man.
I have been in this house for 17 months with 4 people, and I'm the only one cleaning anything. It's rough.
That's a mom phrase right there.
Yeah, it is. Look, you can even see my piles of laundry.
I noticed the Target. That's how the fancy people.
I'm just like kind of elbowing. There's like a pile of clothes that just kind of keeps kind of falling in on me, and I'm just nudging it out of the way. Just that's why we don't do video. Well, there's a lot of reasons we don't
do video. There's a lot of reasons why we don't do video.
I feel like it would change the whole vibe. Like, honestly, I could just imagine us, like, getting all dolled up, getting the lighting just right, and then we would, like, the entire podcast would be us being like, hello, Anna. Hello, Emily. Hello. We're here to discuss books today, because we would feel like we were putting on a show. So, nah, we don't want that.
Nope.
Although, oh, no, people won't, it'll be too late. No. Well, anyway, I'm doing a Pub Talk Live on Saturday with Sarah Nicholas, so if anyone would like to see me on video, it will be on Sarah's YouTube channel, because it's live on Saturday, but then it will be up. So, yes. So you will see me in my carefully cleaned area wearing makeup and everything.
This shot.
In my workout clothes.
This is real. This is raw. This is what the people want.
Nah. We'll keep the evidence to a minimum. But, yeah. Anyway, speaking of messy. Ooh, I have a transition.
Oh, speaking see, I had a transition earlier, but then I moved away. I transitioned from my transition, and now it's your turn to transition.
Because we're talking about, like, messy middles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mine was, oh, no. I think it was like, oh, no, oh, no. And I was like, that's exactly what I say when I go to write the messy middle.
See, I actually don't. I like the messy middle probably because I'm a mess. But it is a challenging part of the book. I love middles.
That's a middle. That's great. I'm glad you do.
Well, because, I mean, the reason that middles are hard is because they often end up being kind of meandering and the pacing gets slow and things get kind of mushy. And
yeah.
But the reason that that happens is because of all the things that I like. I like characters just getting to know each other. I love dialogue. I love those interactions. And so if you give me a part of a book where there is less guidance about, you know, plot points or things that have to happen, I get to just play. And then, of course, in revision, I have to do all that stuff. But I like writing the middles just because I'm like, I've already introduced my characters. I've gotten to know them because, again, I'm a very exploratory writer. So that first act for me is a lot of getting to know my characters, figuring out what they want, what they need, how they interact with each other. And the middle is when I get to just, like, put them in situations and bounce them off each other. And that's a lot of fun. Drafting, again. Then revision comes around and I have to find some structure to it, which is harder. So, yeah.
I know the grass is always greener on the other side, but what's it like to just... just be like, I'm going to explore and I'm going to play.
It's
like
messy.
This is Play-Doh. And have fun.
You end up with a table covered in Play-Doh bits. And then you have to clean it up.
Oh, see.
This really is our
theme. Do you remember Rocko's Modern Life?
Yes.
Do you remember Filbert the turtle?
Yes.
That's me when I write. So it's like, I have all the Play-Doh, and it's like, okay, I have all these pieces. Now what do I do with them? And then I'm like, well, if I take this character and I put it with this kid, nope, those colors don't match. And then I put them away back in there. I re-put them back in the Play-Doh tube. And then I'm like, okay, we got it. We can't mess up this canvas.
Yeah, and see, I'm that kid that you end up with each Play-Doh tub has all the mixed up colors. I know, which look, I'm not saying that's a good thing. But yeah, it's just a lot of experimentation. But then again, I still have to then make it make sense at some point. I mean, it makes sense.
Oh, same.
Yeah.
Same. Absolutely same. I think one of the things that helped me kind of make sense of messy middles and make them a little less terrifying, because they are indeed 50% of your book.
Yes. Although, are we
doing I am doing four-act structure, not three-act structure.
So they are not 50%. So we're dividing it into chunks.
Yeah. Yes. So, like, I'm talking about messy middle as in, like, both of those two middle acts are 50% of your book together. And if you think of the traditional three-act structure, that's 50% of your book.
Yes.
So, like, that's why messy middles are so scary.
Yeah.
But when you think of them as two acts, it's like, I'm not thinking of 50%.
Yeah.
I'm thinking
not of nearly 25. As intimidating. Yeah. And then you're thinking of getting from that setup to that midpoint.
Look and at you me, using like, that lingo.
Yeah. Well, I have a printout. A printout.
We it's both a, made sure to come prepared.
Look, it's even a tent. Look, Anna, it's a tent. There's tent poles.
Whoa.
I know, right? I want to credit it. My computer was being a pain in the butt, so I don't have the credit. But look, it's got first plot point, pinch points, midpoint, shift bit. So, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. You came prepared with handouts.
It can happen. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, we're getting from that setup. We talked about the setup last time. Yes. We did that thing. We talked about the setup. And now we're getting from, you know, our character has, you know, they know what their challenge is. They have made a decision of some sort, and now we have to get them to that midpoint.
Yes.
And that, I feel like, to me, is a much clearer path than trying to say, okay, now get to the darkest moment with a midpoint in the middle. Like, that's too much for me.
That was so scary to me in learning when I first learned structure was everybody was hyping the three-act structure.
Mm-hmm.
And why wouldn't you? I mean, it works. It is basic storytelling, but it is basic storytelling. And there were so many times that I was like, okay, I get that from break into act two all the way to the darkest moment is fun and games. Hooray. Yeah. I know that something big happens at the climax. Hooray. But what about that nebulous 25% or ish right here between the climax? What is that?
And I think for me, a big part of it was really digging into what a midpoint was and figuring out, because once I know what the midpoint is, what that huge shift is going to be for the midpoint, then it clarifies for me what has to happen before that and what has to happen after that. Because so much for me of my storytelling is the character relationships. And so for me, the midpoint is usually a big shift, a big, when the character learns something new, dramatically new about another main character, about themselves or something. And so for me, as someone who loves to write these scenes where characters are bouncing off each other, where there's dialogue, where there's this interaction, where there's various forms of tension, especially in a story that has any sort of romantic element, I need to really think about, okay, well, what is happening in this midpoint? Because that tells me, okay, this interaction has to happen before it.
Yes.
Because whatever happens in this midpoint is going to change those relationships in a way that suddenly all these interactions are going to be impacted by it. So that really helps me to kind of narrow in on this, what we're going to call Act Two, which is, you know, the second quarter of the book, because that puts some boundaries, like some bumpers on it.
For me. And I think it's understanding what, and you might not know when you first draft, but it's understanding what you want to happen during that midpoint.
Yes.
Like some people call it a reversal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It depends on the story, right? What you want it to do. So does it reverse everything? Does it change it in a different direction? I think the thing I'm going to keep from our original discussion is this idea of a status quo.
Yeah.
And so Act One is setting up the character's status quo and why it can't keep going this way, why that's, you know, infinitely wrong for your character, for the world, for whatever. And then Act Two establishes a whole new status quo. And I think especially typically with like young adult or middle grade, it's the character reacting to a lot of things. And sometimes I like to think of the midpoint as they are no longer reacting. They are now acting. Or if they've been acting, it's no longer failing, it succeeds. Something like that. So it's like a total reversal of that.
Yes.
Not like reversal. Because the term reversal is such a weird thing for me.
Yeah, I think of it more as a kind of a something fundamental changes. So I kind of think of it as like we set up, you know, we have Act One where we find out the problem. The character kind of decides on a course of action. Mm-hmm. And for me, a lot of time, it's that Act Two is the character pursuing that course of action in the way that makes the most sense initially.
Yeah.
And it's usually not getting them where they need to go still. So they're kind of heading in the right direction, but things aren't necessarily clicking the way they have to. Like maybe they have their new crew of people and they're starting to learn how to get along, but they still haven't cracked whatever they need to crack. And that midpoint a lot of times is some new information that suddenly changes the rules of the game. It can, you know, turn up the stakes, or it can provide a promising new opportunity for how they can accomplish this or something like that. But it's that, you know, this chunk here is sort of where it's really where I really think of our first, like, especially in an ensemble kind of book. It's where our cast is getting to know each other. They're trying to learn how to work together, but maybe they haven't fully clicked as a team. Maybe they're still butting heads or whatever it is. And a lot of times that midpoint is kind of a big moment where things click between some characters, at least. Because I find a lot of times the midpoint is the moment where you suddenly really are on the same page with other characters. Not always, but that is one common thing that happens in a midpoint.
Yeah.
The team comes together for real for the first time.
Yeah. It's I do like the idea of, like, the team, like, if we look at that, I'm going to go back to the beginning of Act 2 there and say, you know, the status quo has changed. Sometimes we call it crossing the threshold or break into Act 2. This is where they meet the characters that are going to help them along the way, like you were talking about. Mm-hmm. This is where they meet their crew, the people who are going to carry them forward, right? And if it is something like that, they don't get along or, you know, they're constantly butting heads over something, or one person wants to do it one way and the other person wants to do it another way, or whatever. That's happening.
Or they're trying to figure out kind of who is the leader of this group, and there's disagreement. There's, you know.
Yes. The things that they're trying are failing. It gets confusing because
they talk about fun and games, and I remember being a little confused by that in the beginning, because a lot of times when I think of fun and games, I think of fun. I think the characters are having fun, but it's not necessarily fun and games for the character. It's fun and games for the reader. It's those, you know, training montages where, you know, your main character just keeps getting knocked down. They just keep getting knocked down, which the character's not enjoying that, but we as a reader or we as a movie watcher enjoy watching the character be like, I'm going to fight, I'm going to be the best, and they just, you know, they're... you know, wizened old mentor just keeps knocking them back down and saying, get back up, whatever it is.
And I think you and I had this discussion. I don't think we had it on the podcast. I think we had it just in WhatsApp. But it was the fun and games is such a, like, again, it's almost like that reversal, that word reversal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work for everything. And that's why if somebody says, this is the writing advice you have to follow, they're a liar. Don't listen to them. but the fun and games itself isn't just fun and games. It depends on the genre. And I think you and I had a conversation about gothic romance. Because I eat gothic romance up all day long.
Yeah.
But I totally understand for some readers, if they pick up a gothic romance, they're, if you think of fun and games as like training montages and funny, funny buddy cop kind of stuff and like goofy moments – in a gothic romance, it's usually not that. It's, it's fun and games for someone who likes gothic romance. Mm-hmm. So this is the flirtatious looks. This is the a ghost thing happened. This is the like very much aesthetic moody stuff that you look forward to when you pick up a gothic romance. And I think that also ties into what they call the promise of the premise.
Yes.
So the premise of a gothic romance is that you are going to get moody hand touches. Mm-hmm. You're going to get lace dresses. You're going to get, you know, these things that happen.
Yeah.
But for somebody else who picks it up, that's not fun and games. Because they're also, like, I would really say, like gothic romance.
Okay. Yeah. And I would say in general, romance, you know, like I love an enemies to lover. I love a, you know, and so I feel like Act 2, that's also probably why I really love Act 2 so much. Because that's when you get to have fun with that.
Yes.
Because in general, with any sort of enemies to lovers or rivals to lovers or, you know, enemies to friends or just we don't get along to we get along, this is the act where they don't get along.
Yes.
And you get to mess with them and they get to get on each other's nerves. So in any kind of romance story, you generally don't want them to be happily romantic by Act 2 because then there's you've lost the tension. There isn't as much of a goal. Uh-huh. So a lot of times in a romance, the setup is meeting our characters and figuring out why this is not going to be a super easy road for them. Act 2 is when they can't quite make this thing work or there's this kind of looming problem. And a lot of times the midpoint is the first point where someone realizes, like, oh no, I have feelings.
Yes.
So this Act 2 is just this, that's the fun and game. So for people who like the tension of a, you know, again, whether it's enemies to lovers or whether it's just people, what did Lauren Blackwood call it? Irritating to lovers, something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is the act where you really get to have fun with that because they're both not admitting that there's any affection whatsoever. This is just the butting heads teasing each other, banter, 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 banter. And a lot of times then in Act 3, something happens in the midpoint that changes that. And you can still have a lot of fun with that in Act 3, but the tone has shifted a bit. So I really like this part of a book. Because even if it's not a romance, this to me is the part of the book where you can put every character that clashes together and make them clash. That's just so fun.
And I think that goes back to this makes us seem really smart. We planned it. didn't we?
Totally.
The topic of tropes, right? This is the importance of, I think this is the importance of leaning into tropes, because if you know, oh, I'm going to write a best friends to lovers story. Okay, great. Act one is setting up, these are best friends. Mm-hmm. And then act two is where it's like, uh-oh, I want to be more than best friends, but that's not going to work.
I can't say that. Because
what if my friend leaves me? And what if I don't have a friend anymore? And then you get to like do those awkward little funny moments in there. And I think that really can help you plan out what your act two and act three are about.
I also think a lot of act two is, you know, they talk a lot about sort of the a reminder of what they're up against or what the antagonist is. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times they're still kind of off the page. It's not a looming date. So you have to kind of remind the reader in act two what the problem is, that they that you keep that tension up, that you keep that going. But there's also some room to sort of let your characters work on things without directly impacting the antagonistic forces as much as they're going to in act three. So I feel like there's a lot of that. Like there's usually a lot of times what kicks off act two is sort of a like, dun, dun, dun. Now there's a deadline, or now there's a something else. Now there's more pressure on this character. Now that's why they had to make a choice. So we've got that reminder. We know that now. And now it's like, all right, well, what are we going to do about it? And what is that going to look like? So how is the hero going to respond to that antagonistic force,
right,
or the heroes? And also I think act two is a really important part for readers to really connect with that main character. Because in that first act, we've introduced who they are, and we've kind of promised the reader, look, you're going to want to stick around for this person's story. But for me, act two is when you actually really get to know them. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they are put in new situations. You get to see them reacting to new people. You get to see them reacting to new challenges, and you get to know them just on a much deeper level.
Yeah. And I think that right there, the idea of knowing them by a deeper level, that is something that is so magical to me. You know, when you read it in a book and it's done well, you're like, this is it. Like, this is, there's something that makes it feel like this is more than just a book. Like, these characters exist beyond this page. And that is just something that's so difficult and so wonderful to do. And it is that idea of setting up in act one. You think you know this character.
Mm-hmm.
You think you know everything. You think they, you know how they're going to respond to something. But then you put them in the situation and you don't know how they're going to respond, or you're surprised by how they respond. And that really kind of builds the foundational stuff for that third act where it becomes less reactive and more active.
Yeah.
And
I think too, like, you know, that first chapter, you know, we talked about how much stuff has to go in the first chapter. I think a lot of what makes a first chapter intense is because you're trying to kind of say, you're trying to hint at or promise a lot of the things that are going to start coming to fruition in act two. So, you know, I had talked about how in my debut, this Vicious Grace, added on Goodreads, I had a challenging road because a lot of act one is meeting Alessa and seeing what kind of a dire situation she's in.
Mm-hmm.
But act two and act three are when you really, when you get kind of that gooey rom-com center, you get that banter, you get that sense of humor. She finally gets a chance to kind of like loosen her shackles a little bit. And so what I was really trying to do is in the opening chapter, allude to enough of that, that people who wanted more of that can also, like, that it's enough to kind of propel them through the setup of, like, yeah, things are really rough. And then act two is when you start to finally, those hints of humor, the hint of, you know, the things that she's wanted all along, she's going to start getting just enough of those that we really get to experience that with her, and she gets to kind of become the character that we got a hint of in the first chapter. And I think that that is just, for me as a writer, that's why I really enjoy this part of the book so much, because it's where I really get to let my characters become fully who it is that they are. And they're still going to grow and change, but I think a lot in act one is so much of just like, they're, like you said, they're reacting to all these things being thrown at them. They make a decision to do something, and then act two is when we actually get to see them just doing stuff and taking charge. Uh-huh. And a lot of times the decisions they make and the way they take charge isn't necessarily going to get them all the way through it, but it's fascinating to watch them try and often fail.
Right. And I think attaching on to that, the idea of trying and failing, for those of you who like want to write from a character standpoint, I think that is where they are clinging. We talk about the lie they tell themselves, the misbelief, right? And they cling to that misbelief, right? This misbelief of, you know, I'm not worthy of being loved unless I, you know, toil away forever for somebody, right? Yeah. Like, I'm not worthy of affection. There's
or even the lie of, I don't like this other character, or I don't like these other characters. A lot of times this is the kind of, you start to see the cracks in the people that don't get along. You start to see the hints of, you know, especially like with an ensemble cast, if it's not multiple point of view, a lot of times you're introducing these characters, and this act is when you're starting to see glimpses of sort of their sense of humor, or the way that they handle problems, or maybe that they're not exactly who they seemed at first introduction. And it's right. just sort of all these moving pieces that is a lot of fun to play with as a very character-driven writer.
Exactly, exactly. And then I think for me, just approaching that midpoint, if we're done, like, talking about Act 2, is there anything else you want to, like, because I'm going to go talk about that midpoint and move into Act 3.
I wanted to say that I really have come to appreciate the, what is it, the reflecting on where they've been. I can't think of the exact phrase.
Oh, yeah.
The comparison. There's often a moment, especially leading up to the midpoint, where the main character suddenly realizes, like, wow, things are really different now than they were in the beginning.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the midpoint either ramps that up or turns it on its head. But you have this moment of, like, the character kind of starts to realize how far they've come already. And I think that can be a really satisfying part of the book.
Yeah, that's one of those beats that I'll admit, you know, it's there in stories, like you see it in movies and you read it in books all the time, but I've never seen it on an act sheet. Like I've never seen it on the story structure of this idea. I've never, ever seen it. You mentioned that when I was going through revisions on my last one, on my last project. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I actually had that scene in there and then I deleted it. And putting it back in is such a satisfying thing, because it is a moment of power for that character to say, this is the relationship I used to have. Mm-hmm. This is awful and toxic and horrible. And I'm so much better off and I don't need you. Goodbye. I'm going to keep going. And it is that propeller into the rest of the story of this. Yeah. Like, it gives them that confidence to, again, if you're thinking of that lie, that misbelief, it lets them know that misbelief was awful and harmful and I don't want to be that anymore, and I'm really doing okay, so I'm gonna keep going.
Yeah.
And
well, I think for me it's
the story.
It's the scene that I allude to all the time. Again, this is not a spoiler. It's the my characters, you know, playing a drinking game. And I think that's the reason why so many people really, that scene resonates with people, because that to me is very much a, like, wow, this is very different. This is a very different situation. This character is in a different situation than she was at the beginning of this book. And it feels good, because her setup at the beginning of the book is rough. I think that's often an area where I write some of my most fun scenes.
I forgot what I was going to say about a midpoint.
They exist.
That's...
And they're a doozy.
Shoot. I forgot what it was. I got so excited about talking about that. No, it was me.
I can read what it says on my sheet.
Yeah, tell us.
Okay. Again, this is not mine. I will try to forget who to credit it to once my computer stops being weird. It says, the midpoint shift/twist parts the curtains of superior knowledge. How does this happen for the hero and or the reader? How does it shift the context of the story? Pump up dramatic tension and pace. How does the antagonistic force respond to this attack? Remember those intern demons. And then later we get to the all is lost lull before the second plot point, which I think the all is lost lull is not my favorite way to describe it.
Woof.
I like the calm before the storm, but we'll get to that later.
Woof.
Yeah.
All you read for midpoint there, woof.
You don't like
this
it?
This is – midpoints are impossible for me because I have now gotten to the point where I'm like, is this the midpoint or is this midpoint?
A lot of times when I first start brainstorming, a lot of times what I think is my darkest moment is actually my midpoint. And then my darkest moment is so much worse.
Yes.
Because again, I have so much fun in Act 2 that a lot of times the midpoint is a like, oh no, because you have to have that shift in tone. And so for me, because I love Act 2s, my characters are starting to find I have fun, that midpoint has to be a like, oh, why is the fun ending kind
and
of
I
moment?
I think what it happens for me right there, like what you were talking about, is it that shift, that tonal shift, it can either be things start to succeed and they're going great and things are awesome and fantastic and woohoo. And that's why the darkest moment is so heavy is because everything's going great, but actually those bad guys are closing in, as per the phrase. But the more I figure out about my own, and I was almost like Canadian there, about The more I figure out about my own like writing style, I don't think the midpoint for me is usually something big and dramatic. And a lot of times when you read about midpoints, they make it seem like it has to be something that's big and dramatic and huge and monumental. And it's like, it could just be like your character confesses their love and the other person says, oh,
see, okay. I would argue, as someone that's so character and emotion based, to me that feels just as dramatic. I don't think it has to be an explosive moment.
That.
Like, physically, it has to be a moment. Like, to me, it's a moment where the episode ends and you stare at the screen for a second.
Yes.
You know, like you said, a character says, I love you, and the other character goes, and you're like, no, that was not what was supposed to happen. And it's just, there is that. A lot of times there's either an oh no moment, and we talk a lot about the reversal too, and some story structures talk about kind of like the setup for the midpoint, and then the reversal. And at first that was very confusing to me, and now I get it, because again, I love watching movies, and a lot of times in a movie, a midpoint is that like, oh no, like that person hurt my feelings, so they don't feel the same way. And then the reversal is the opposite, is when they kind of reconnect or they hash it out and finally come together like as a team or as a duo or whatever.
Something that I've also realized is that because of this character arc, you know, this idea of internal stakes, right? This lie that they're fighting against, this misbelief that they're fighting against. I feel like Act 3's, yes, there is a lot of action in Act 3, a lot of things happening in Act 3. Because again, the antagonist is like closing in, or the threat is closing in. But I also think this is the moment where it's the most internal conflict, because they have put their heart on the line. This is the moment where they're not reacting. They are acting and they are pushing, and they're just saying, I'm going to put all my chips on the table and I'm going to go for this thing. And if it fails, I don't know what I'll do. And that right there is the darkest moment, right? Where it's
Act 3, I feel like, is now suddenly they have something. They've gained something. Now they have more to lose. They didn't think they could have more to lose, but they do, because now there are more things that they care about, more things that they're invested in.
That team that they struggled to get along with in Act 2.
Yeah,
they're finally found connected. Now they're
found family. And now it's like, oh, suddenly that battle is more stressful. Because now, you got more on the line.
Yeah, but that's not why just your life. It's everyone.
The all is lost lull. So again, I feel like for the longest time I was like, there's like a darkest moment, but then there's a black moment, and then there's a calm before. And for me, I've kind of actually, again, I know I always come back to romance, but romance for me really helped me understand this, because so often in a romance novel, cover your ears, children, that calm before the storm is when our couple finally consummates their relationship. They are finally together. They are a happy couple. And then our darkest moment is when it all falls apart. The secrets that have been brewing come to light, or they are forcibly separated, or something catastrophic happens. So you have to have this, again, like calling it a lull feels incorrect, because it's not, it's really more of the like, it's that moment where as a reader, you're like, oh, this is so nice. It's definitely going to turn bad real soon. Like, this is too nice. No one can be this happy. You get one chapter where you're happy, and then something's going to take it all away.
It is that moment, and I think you talked about it, and this is why your child and I should watch TV together, we should watch movies together. I can't – it's in Disney, especially Pixar movies. They do such a good job of – Oh, no.
Yeah.
This is so great. It's going to go very bad, and I know exactly how it's going to go bad.
It sounds so counterintuitive, because we've been talking all along about, like, dropping in those hints and reminding people that trouble is to come. But if you've done that well, then if you get to a point where everything is clicking and everyone is getting along, that suddenly feels just way too good to be true, and it's almost just as ominous as the actual ominous moment.
Did you watch Luca?
Yes.
Okay. I think of Luca as a perfect example of that. I know there's a lot of discussion about Luca and it not being the greatest Pixar movie ever, and those people can come physically fight me.
But I'm sorry, you guys. Like the aesthetic, add my book on Goodreads.
Add her book.
It's that one. That is not the Amalfi Coast. It's a different coast, but you get the idea.
You get the idea. But I think that one is such a great example, because you have the two main characters, the two boys that are trying to get their Vespa, right? The tension for me in Luca doesn't lie with Luca himself. It lies with Alberto.
Alberto.
But I think it lies with him, because they set his character up so wonderfully to just, there's a moment where it's like, my dad is out and he'll be coming back. And I just looked at Steven and said, oh no, oh no. And then you can tell that he has like the abandonment issues. Mm-hmm. He has the, this is my only friend. This is my family. No one else can be part of this family. And you just know, you absolutely know that jealousy is just going to build and build and build. And no matter how happy they are as a trio, Julia, Luca, Alberto, you know, he's never going to let it go until things get bad. And there was that scene that I just melted. Because I was like, this is not going to be good. This is not going to be good. And then I think the thing that was so cool was that it was talking about learning from characters. It's, mm-hmm. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Luca, turn this off right now and then come back in a minute. But the moment where Luca pushes Alberto into the water, mm-hmm. and he's like, not, he pushes him, he falls in the water and he like needs his help and he's like, a sea monster. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I just remember being so shocked.
Yeah.
Because once I thought about it, I was like, of course Luca would do that.
Yeah.
But that's so bad. And like,
so for anyone tuning back in, thanks for waiting a minute. Speaking of my child and Pixar movies and Disney movies and all of that, one of the tricks that I found, so Anna knows, my child gets very stressed out by movies. She's a clever little thing, and she's very, she's what my mom would call an emotional barometer. She can sense the mood of a thing. And so what we do a lot of times is we will watch Act One, and I will pause it, you know, a quarter of the way through the movie, and I will ask her, what does this character want? What's the worst thing that could happen to them? And she nails it every single time. By the time we're done with Act One, or even, you know, maybe Act Two, I can ask her, okay, what's important to this character? What do they want? What do they get? What do they really, really want? So, and once she knows, what does this character really want? And what does it look like they're getting? What is the darkest moment going to be? And because she can say, okay, this character really wants a friend more than anything in the world, and now they have a friend, and I say, what's the darkest moment going to be? And she'll say that they're going to lose their friend, or their friend's going to get hurt. And because she understands that, then it allows her to get through it. Mm-hmm. Because we get to that part and she starts to whimper and she scrunches up next to me, or, you know, or she'll know that like she's, so-and-so is going to betray so-and-so. They're going to tell the truth about this thing, whatever it is. And because of that, it allows her to kind of weather the storm. But I think it's a beautiful example of how even as an 8-year-old, she can understand story structure in a way that allows her to process the story. And I think all of us are doing that all the time, even if we don't realize it. We are making a prediction, you know, because like that moment you said where this character said this line and you thought, oh, no, that's exactly what my 8-year-old would do. She would say, oh, no, that means that this is not going to happen. Or like if this person says, you know, I just can't wait for my mom to show up at my final ballet performance, it's like, oh, that darkest moment is going to be that mom's not going to show up in time or whatever it is. But I find it fascinating. And it's really fun to watch, to explain story structure to children, because I think it allows them, especially if you have like a high strung child in your life, it gives them the tools to handle it so it doesn't feel unpredictable. It doesn't feel like something is coming around the curve and is going to emotionally blindside them because they can prepare for it. But it's also just fascinating as a writer, like watching how, I don't want to say easily, but kind of how intuitively even a young child can understand the elements of a story. And story structure.
Because it's just ingrained in us as people, like as the human race. Storytelling is just in...
Yeah.
It's in there. It's in that DNA. We get it.
Yeah, which is this hot topic. Hot topic on Twitter. Dangerous. I won't offer an opinion, but there was a bunch of tweets the other day from romance fans saying, like, why do we have to have a breakup in Act 3? Like, and this is a tricky one because romance readers specifically often prefer romance because it is a genre that you know is going to have a happy ending. You know, so the predictability is the safety of it. It is a very comforting genre. It is, you know, and so when you self-select for a group of readers that are specifically, and it's not true for some romance readers read for very different reasons, but there is a subset of romance readers that reads it simply because the books don't stress them out because they know it's going to have a happy ending. And a subset of that group also doesn't want the tension of the breakup. They don't, you know, they just want the happy stuff, which I completely understand, but also as a writer, it's really hard to write an effective book if you don't have a darkest moment, because the end, it's hard to make an ending satisfying.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be a breakup. I think the point was just, it doesn't have to be a breakup. It doesn't have to be a breakup. But
yeah,
it's a tricky line. It's a very tricky line to walk in a genre where readers don't always want that much angst or emotional punch. Because yeah, again, to get a satisfying act four, there has to be something that doesn't go right in act three. Otherwise, it's just characters wandering around.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's tricky. Whereas in, like, YA fantasy, there are no limits. No limits to how dark you can go. The darker, often, the better.
Yeah.
It's just a different approach. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the thing, like, right there. It's a different approach. And I can't speak so much for romance because I don't read as much romance widely. But I think the idea there is that it doesn't always have to be the same darkest moment.
Absolutely.
I think that's what I interpret it as. And if you actually look at, if you look at fantasy stories, there is no limit, but then there typically becomes like cliche things that are like just part of the story. And it's like, yeah, that's always, you know, if you look at a Marvel film, the darkest moment is always going to be the hero and everybody abandons them. And then they have to, like, you know, it's like I can pick like that. I just described like five different Marvel films. Yeah. So it's like, can it be something else?
Yeah. And again, like, I'm not criticizing that request. It was just one of those moments where I thought, like, it's so hard. Yeah. And it's such a complicated conversation because I do think there are genuinely, you know, there's a chunk of readers that really would just prefer to skip all the angst of Act 3 in general. And that's totally understandable. As an author, it's kind of hard to write that and make it work as a story for everyone else. Like, if you're trying to please too many readers. But I think that's why especially romance has so many kind of subgenres, because there are certain, you know, for example, I won't name it, even though I love it. There is an author who has recently become very successful with a couple of, you know, major bestseller books that are under the romance genre. And they're the sort of books that I've noticed that people with similar tastes in books as me absolutely love them. Uh-huh. But some rom-com readers really don't. And I think it's one of those you cannot please all the people. And it's because, in my mind, these books don't shy away from some really rough emotional stuff. They don't shy away from darkest moments that really rip your heart out. And so if you're a fan that goes into romance because you don't want angst and you don't want drama and you just want happy and fun, these are not the romance books for you.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas if you're someone like me that loves romance, but I also kind of, I'm a glutton for punishment. Like, I want it to hurt a little bit. I love these books. I love them because they're so layered and complex. And so I think I also struggle with that. There's also an ongoing conversation about, you know, I'm not going to get into it too much, but like YA versus adult fantasy. And a lot of the thing you hear, again, I'm not going to, Anna's like running away. Is that
I am like, do you know that meme with the seagull where the seagull is like, country road, take me home. And then it just reaches forward and screams. Yes. That's me right now. I was just taking my big breath before I started screaming. And like, I don't want to make it a big deal. And
I'm not going to go into the whole thing of what belongs where. But one thing that I've realized that I get stuck on a bit is a lot of the – I've heard people say, oh, YA writers and readers who want romance in their books should just move up to adult because a fantasy romance is a thing. And I will say, yes, fantasy romance is a thing. Romantic fantasy is a thing. They're not the same thing. And I think that's often where people kind of run into hurdles because fantasy romance fans expect it to be a romance. There are rules in a romance. A romance must have a happy ending. Romantic fantasy fans often like all the same ingredients, but are very fine with books that don't end with a happy ending, or books that end on a cliffhanger, or books that are duologies or series where you're going to be more stressed out. And I don't think that publishing has done a great job of telling people how to differentiate the two or how to find one versus the other. Because if you try to sell a book as a fantasy romance and it ends on a cliffhanger, or our characters are, you know, our two main characters, our love interests are separated, fantasy romance fans will often get real mad at you, justifiably, because you're not coming through on your promise. But again, I find that a lot of romantic fantasy fans like the pressure of not knowing what is going to happen, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I'm just trying to go back. Maybe I missed it. Mm-hmm. This seems like a an argument between genres.
It is, but I think what not happens is
adult,
I think
young
I,
adult.
I well, don't and I think I think concern. What it is that for the most part, I think in YA, it's romantic fantasy. Sometimes it has a happy ending. Sometimes it doesn't. There's a big desire for books that have a lot of romance, but that are mostly following the rules of fantasy. And one of the rules of fantasy is that you don't know how that book's going to end in terms of, like, you can kill off characters, stuff like that. Whereas in fantasy romance, in general, there's going to be less tolerance for killing off of characters, and there's going to be no tolerance for not happy endings. And in the adult sphere, I think there is a lot more fantasy romance, especially in the indie pub, you know, group of writers. And so I think one thing that adult has, you can't just say take all the books that have romance and YA and age them up and like pick where they belong, because I just think it gets more complicated. I guess what I'm saying is that YA readers, for the most part, YA fantasy readers, even those who really like romance, do not expect fantasy to follow the romance rules. Whereas once you get into adult, then you have to clearly delineate whether something is a romantic fantasy or a fantasy romance, or you risk alienating readers. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I was trying to think if I have one. I don't have anything critical. Like, I don't have anything constructive. Not critical.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a criticism.
I don't have anything constructive to say to this, but I do have...
We can cut it out if you want.
Anna was, in fact, not good to go. She had to spend about 10, 20 minutes rambling with Emily about this thing that she brought up, and Anna just couldn't comprehend. So instead, you get some elevator music and some excerpts of what was said during that time. Enjoy. When I was a teenager, I was like, who are you people? Are you kidding?
I can't.
Then don't read it.
Don't read it. Stop. Get out.
We're back. This is Anna and Emily touched the hot stove, and then we decided not to touch the hot stove publicly. But anyway, fascinating discussions to be had about fantasy across age groups and genres. Yeah.
That was my dark night of the soul. I had a dark night of the soul there. I did. I had all is lost. And now I'm back.
Just trust that I will be out here until next June reminding everyone my book is a romantic fantasy and it is a YA crossover. YA crossover. Just telling you that right now. And people who know, know. And people who don't. That's fine. Just saying. Sorry. I touched the hot stove again. Anyway, moving on. Impulse control is not my strength. Okay. All right. Dark moments. Well, are we going to save the dark moment for... I can never decide. Is the dark moment in... Is it the end of Act 3 or is it the start of Act 4?
I think that is exactly what we talked about with Act 1, where it's break into Act 2. First plot point. Where does that happen? I typically think... I don't know. I don't have a...
I think the moment the thing happens is the end of Act 3. Yeah. And then there's that, the like dark night of the soul where you sit around and feel sad. That to me is the beginning of Act 4.
Yes. I agree. Because I think
I also thought were the same thing for the longest time.
Incident, first plot point. So dark night of the soul is your inciting incident to get them to do the first plot point.
Yeah.
Which is ruminating of how do I move forward.
Yes, exactly. Right? A lot of times, Act 4 is going to start with that, like,
Oh, no.
What do I do?
I lost it all.
Yeah. So, and I like to end Act 3 with that, you know, that gasp. That's not the episode. That's the end of the season that makes you yell at the showrunners because you have to wait a whole year until the show comes back.
Yes.
It's that.
And I think, again, just going back, trying to like reclaim some of my chill and actually talk seriously. I think using that word status quo again, that phrase status quo.
Yeah.
Again, the midpoint, nothing can keep going the way it was in Act 2. Something has to change.
Something changes so dramatically in the midpoint that it changes something that you can't go back. You can't unknow it. You can't unfeel it. You can't unsay it. It has been known, said, or felt.
And I think the same thing is with the Dark Night of the Soul. Yes. That's the big reveal. That's where the secrets they've been holding on are revealed. This is where the animosity they've been harboring mm-hmm. is acted upon, and they can't
or the ever thing they were most the afraid of the thing they were most afraid of in act yep. one has just happened. I think yep. I had a big conversation actually with my agent about this, trying to make sure I do in an unspoiler way, about whether or not it is acceptable for the darkest moment to feel like it kind of shoves the character right back where they started. We ended up coming with a solution that I feel like hit both of it, but just originally in a draft, she kind of had expressed concern that like, well, is it, are readers going to feel like, well, why did we do all this if we're back where we started? And anyway, that was kind of an older dark moment. We changed it a bit, but my argument was, I think that that is perfectly fine and often good as an element of the darkest moment. Again, there has to be, you really have to feel like something has changed that no, they can't really go back to where they are, but that what they were afraid of, their worst case scenario, the one thing they didn't want to happen, or, you know, whatever it is that they were looking for in act one, that they've made such huge strides, things have changed, they have those friends, or they have that team, or they have that army, or they're ready to, whatever it is, all the things that they have been working so hard to build, a lot of times that dark moment is the moment where they feel like they've lost it all.
Yeah.
And it is sort of that feeling of like, what was all of this for?
Yeah. And it's the whole thing of, why do we fall, Bruce? Right? Like, that's all I keep thinking is, like, why do we fall? Like, you have to have that moment where you actually fall.
Yeah. And because that part of the process then is them realizing how much they've changed and how much has changed. Even though it feels like they've lost everything, have they really lost everything?
I really, really love. And that was one of my books before this one. Mm-hmm. I think it was two books before this one that I wrote where they literally end up right back where they started, but they know things now. They can do things now.
Yes, they have that's how I think of it. Yes, before. You it's end up back where you started in so many ways, but you're not who you were when the book started. Exactly. The character is not the same character, and so they're going to handle things differently, or the people around them are going to handle things differently.
It's so exciting.
But yeah, that's it's like that it's like act up. Two and act three. You're handing them all these things, and then act four, you're running up and just smacking them out of their hands.
Right.
And we authors are evil because, man, they're fun to write. Whoo, they're fun to write. I do love a dark moment.
Oh, so good. I feel better now.
Yeah.
I feel good.
We came through the darkest moment. We did it.
It was scary there for a minute.
It was. We were dancing around on hot stoves.
Yep.
It's fine.
I feel like I'm ready for an act four. So that was really fun. Emily, what is your goal for this week? What are you doing?
I think finish my past pages. I had kind of doled it out, and I think I was being a little too gentle with myself because I was kind of figuring out like how many pages I had to look at each day to finish it by my deadline, but I don't really think I need that much time. So I am going to try to do maybe like 50 pages a day.
And they're really, very pretty.
They are so pretty. And there's really not much to do. Like, I'm just looking for typos or occasionally, like, a repetitive word. So, because this has already gone through line edits. It's already gone through copy edits. It's come back to me from copy edits. It's gone back to the proofreader. Right. So, yeah, it's just, you know, every time someone tweets about that typo that made it through every single round, this is my chance to go in and be like, maybe I can find those. Maybe I can have the one typo-free book in the history of the planet.
In the history of the planet.
But yeah, although I tweeted this yesterday that it's hard to focus on word by word because I still really like this book. And I just find myself reading it. And I'm like, stop it, Emily, you're not supposed to be reading your book. You're supposed to be like carefully looking at it.
Right.
But, oh, well, I figure hopefully when readers read it, if I missed a typo, they won't notice because they'll be having so much fun reading. So
exactly.
So that's my plan, is to finish that up as quickly as possible so that I can get back to revising the sequel.
Nice.
Yeah. How about you?
Which I need in my inbox.
Yeah, which I need to revise it first because it is not readable.
I don't know about that.
And every time someone reads book one and is excited about the sequel, I sweat just a little bit more.
Don't sweat.
But that's why I need to get it. I need to get it in a really good shape as early as possible because that pressure is just going to ramp up once, you know, advanced reader copies go out and all that stuff. So, So, I mean, it sounds, you know, my diamond shoes are too tight. Like, people seem to really like my book, which is great. But then it means that they want the second book to stand up to it. So I want to make sure I do that. And I think one of the best ways for me to do that is to get as much of it in place before that pressure starts to ramp up. So,
I think that's important. I think that's smart. I can't imagine that pressure, so.
Yeah, well, our ARCs have not gone out yet, but could be soon, so
get it I'm just done.
Gonna, I need to get this first draft. Just get through first draft. Like, I've written it. I just need to turn it into something coherent that will put me in a better headspace to, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what are your goals for this week? To finish reading a thing, maybe sending things.
Maybe. Yes, I'm going to finish reading a thing and send that thing, and that will be done today, actually, the day that we record.
Yes.
And then I'll probably – I've been brainstorming this adult fantasy book idea in my brain. So hopefully – I'm trying to do a really good job of just letting myself ruminate on that. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to let it ruminate. I'm going to build some more. I'm going to really think through some character and plot stuff to try and – figure out at least right now what a midpoint might be, mm-hmm. And then just know that it can shift. But I think I need to have some of those big tentpole things before I actually start drafting, or I will never get it done.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's the goal.
Cool. Yay.
Yeah.
Fun. Woo. And we'll be back next time with Act 4.
Yeah, with Act 4 / Act 3 if you follow the 3 actions. Yeah,
which we do. Bye.
Bye. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Basic Pitches. We super appreciate that you came by and listened. You can find anything that we've talked about in the show notes. You can also find it on our social medias. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @2BasicPitches. Anything and everything that we talk about can always be posted there. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.